help me, if you will, take it as kind of step by step chronologically through some of the significant events that have brought you to this point post 1981, starting kind of with Donald with the Nightfly. How did that kind of give you a direction of what you wanted to do at that time post Steely Dan?
Well, let's see. At that time, Walter and I were working on our own, and that was the first project I did on my own. It's going back to 1981, and I guess that album was really kind of an autobiographical album, which all the songs were set in the early 60s, looking forward to the late 70s or the 80s. And I think, you know, I'm glad that people liked the record, even though it was maybe some of it was a little more esoteric than the most pop music.
It certainly was really important in a couple of ways, other than just musical. I mean, I would say that and Ry Cooder's Bop Till You Drop were two of the most significant albums in kind of ushering in the digital recording age and the compact disc as a medium. Walter, would you agree?
Definitely. I think that those two albums were certainly the first two digital albums, all digital albums that I knew about. And, you know, they were both great sounding albums. So I think they helped make the point that digital multitrack was a good way to go.
There was, of course, you know, classical albums and various other projects had been done digitally for a few years before that. But I think these were the first, you know, mass popular records that were done digitally. And I think Ry Cooder's album was basically done live. That is to say, it was basically a band played in the studio. The Nightfly was a long project using a lot of overdubbing, and at the time that was very difficult on digital because of the problems that were still, technical problems that were still inherent in digital machines. But now they've cleaned those problems up.
Well, yes, absolutely. But it certainly was a significant in the evolution towards really a whole new way for consumers to use you know to enjoy music, and certainly for the musicians to record it. Really a significant album.
Of course, some people would say it was the end of hi-fi.
Yeah, Neil Young loves it. Don't get me started. He still he'll argue that till late in the morning.
Of course, he himself also records on digital multitracks.
Yes, but he does it kicking and screaming.
He doesn't like it, right?
Yeah, kicking and screaming.
Well, I have an old 24-track machine that he could purchase. he really wants to record analog.
I'll tell him.
Glorious time to be free. What a beautiful world this will be. What a glorious sixes in. You'll be a witness to that game of chance in the sky. You know we've got to win. Here at home we'll play in the city. I would buy the sun. Perfect weather for a streamlined world. There'll be spandex jackets, one for everyone.
Would it be safe to say, Donald, that when you were making The Night Fly, could any of what you're doing now, was any of that even a remote possibility?
At the time, I don't think we were really thinking of playing live. We had been focusing on studio work for quite a while by that time.
Walter, when did you move to Hawaii?
I think I moved to Hawaii around 1981.
So it's the same, same period.
Right, exact same period.
Yeah. Besides the obvious desire to live in a tropical paradise, why so far from New York and L.A., the music business meccas at that time?
Well, I think I ended up there partially because of the contrast to living in New York or L.A. You know, it was having spent... as much time as I had living in those two places, when I went to Hawaii for a vacation, it looked like another whole other world and a whole other kind of life to spend time there, and that's what I ended up doing.
You think it was, looking back on it now, could it have been a little more than just geography? I mean, could it have been, in a way, trying to kind of distance yourself from the music business, almost in a geographical sense, by going halfway around the world?
Well, for me, it was more of a change of lifestyle. I had no, you know, as that guy on Saturday Night Live used to say in another context, the music business had been very, very good to me. And I had no gripe with it. But I did feel a powerful attraction to spending a few minutes of the day out of doors. And that was a much more interesting proposition in Hawaii than it had been in New York.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I think, though, you know, there is a trend towards a media flight, you know, lately.
Well, that's the flight that I took out there, was the media flight.
Do you get a meal with that?
Now, where would you go to flee the media just for...
That's the problem. See, people think...
My curiosity.
Media flight is, you know, a tough proposition these days since, you know...
Everywhere you go, there's Japanese cars and American radios, you know, American rock and roll.
Donald, who is Libby Titus, and how and when did you meet her, and what's your relationship with her?
Libby Titus is my wife, and I met her, I actually met her many years ago at different times, but I didn't know her very well until about 6 years ago when we started producing some club gigs together in New York.
So, which came first, the working relationship or the romance?
The working relationship. We started producing shows in clubs, which ended up as the New York Rock and Soul Review, which we we toured with a few years ago.
Right. How instrumental was Libby in getting you to perform live again?
Well, because she had access to clubs and could put on small shows of any kind she wanted, because she was dealing with very small venues. She had some very interesting people that I wanted to play with and that we thought would be interesting. For instance, we did a show with Dr. John early on, just a jazz show, really, with just a few musicians. And it was very small for a couple of years. And then we started, you know, having grandiose ideas about what else we could do.
How did you feel, Donald, about playing Steely Dan songs in the context of the New York Rock and Soul Review then? What was your attitude towards it?
Well, actually, when we first started doing that kind of show, it was really a show devoted to certain composers. For instance, we do a night of Burns and Ragavoy tunes or Burt Bacharach tunes. And at that time, I wasn't doing any material from Steely Dan. But the later format where we had, you know, just tunes that we thought would be interesting from the 50s and 60s and 70s, it seemed like a natural thing to do. And, you know, I think since we were, it was a bigger tour, you know, there was a certain amount of feeling. I didn't want to, like, you know, stiff the audience who might have wanted to hear some of the old tunes.
So it really came kind of organically from the audience just shouting up requests over the night?
Yeah, and I think the fact that the audience, you know, that those tunes got a really great response probably, you know, had at least something to do with the fact that Walter and I decided to go out with these shows in the last couple of years.
You sound a little matter-of-fact about or a hint of surprise that the songs went over that well after the years. Really, were you surprised? Or was there ever a question?
Sure, yeah. You know, you never really know. You know, I hadn't been on the road for 10 years, and it's hard to say. I knew the records were still selling, you know, there's really no way to know, and because, you know, I mean, in a performing mode, you know, I'm as paranoid as anybody, you know, so you never know.
Walter, about this time, you did a project or two for Geffen in a role other than just, you know, front musician. What was it?
Well, I did produce an album for Geffen for Ricky Lee Jones that was called Flying Cowboys.
Nice album.
Yeah, I thought she did a great job, and that was probably the first, you know, lengthy pop album that I had done since the Steely Dan records.
Yeah.
Done a couple of quick ones with an English band named China Crisis, but those were like, you know, it was done, and it was a band, and it was done in a different way.
Right. Your involvement received almost as much attention as a producer, and almost as much ink, because of your legacy with Steely Dan. How did you feel about the attention and interest in you regarding Steely Dan when you would produce?
Well, the main way that helped me was when musicians would come in, I still had some of the goodwill that Donald and I had earned with them through the years doing Steely Dan sessions and so on. And so, you know, they'd come in with a very good attitude, you know, and ready to deliver some fiery performances. And that was particularly helpful.
Donald, would you hear through the grapevine, even there in New York with Walter out in Hawaii? I mean, would Walter just command instant respect as a producer because of his legacy with Steely Dan? I guess that's a loaded question. That's a loaded question.
You remember hearing about that, didn't you?
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, told me about, you know, I instantly respect that guy.
I to this day, I go into the men's room of a restaurant and I'll see a big, like a spray paint thing. I'll say, Walter Becker rules.
It rules.
Yeah.
Okay. Donald, the second New York Rock and Soul Review played some 15 or so selected dates. I had to fly to Detroit to catch you guys on the final night there.
That's a good place to see it.
At Pineop,
right?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Thanks. But the rest of us in the other parts of the country couldn't figure out why the New York Rock and Soul, neither one of the tours, really played that many shows, and they seem to be kind of start in the Midwest and head east.
Actually, part of it was, you know, I hadn't toured in a long time, and I was sort of, I didn't want to do a long tour, and also a lot of the other people had other commitments. You know, we had a big show with, you know, we had Mike McDonald and Phoebe Snow and Boz Scaggs, and they, it's hard to get that group of people together since they had other commitments. So that was, you know, why the tour took the shape it did.
Okay. Walter, when you and I talked in, I guess it was the summer of 1990, early summer, I really didn't get the impression at that time that you were thinking on participating in New York Rock and Soul Review 2. How did you get coaxed off of Tropical Paradise and out there into the rather unglamorous rock and roll touring world?
Well, I was working with Donald on Comicuriad. And they had a rock and soul gig at a club in Midtown. And I foolishly went down there, and I was sitting in the audience of this, what turned out to be a pretty small club. And one of the musicians on the band invited me up on stage to sit in for a number or two in a way that no one could possibly refuse without fear of dismemberment at the hands of the crowd. So I went up and played a couple tunes, and it was great. It was very exciting. And as Donald mentioned, you know, the response to Steely Dan songs was so overwhelming that I figured, hey, this is kind of fun. And so a few months later was the summer tour was set up. So I was invited to come along, and it was a lot of fun.
That's great. It should be. It's what it's supposed to be all about. I've seen a couple of, I'd say two general attitudes by musicians toward assembling career retrospectives. Either an uncomfortable loathing or a sincere desire to represent the body of work. How did you two approach the Citizen Steely Dan box set?
I think a perfect combination. We cut it right down the middle there. We reconciled the seeming discrepancies between sincere desire to set the record straight and loathing, outright self-loathing. We actually, you know, the MCA who owns all the Steely Dan masters wanted to do the box set for quite a while, and we persuaded them to hold off until after Donald's album was out so that it wouldn't, you know, interfere with the marketing push for that. And so while we were waiting, we gathered together all of the little scraps and tidbits in the package there and wrote the little liner notes and got all the tunes remastered and so on.
Yeah, I was fascinated that the booklet that accompanies the music actually starts off with what looks like a faxed letter. Is that real?
Yeah, that was, yes, that was a letter to the our friend Andy McKay over at MCA, who was supervising the assemblage of the material and so on.
You know, I had to ask if it was real because you are the guys who anonymously reviewed your own album once and printed on the back cover, right?
You betcha.
Yeah, I guess we did do that. You know, Andy McKay asked me if we were kidding too when he got the
really
he got the letter. Yeah, he said, "Ah, you guys are kidding with this letter, right?
You must be kidding." He said, "I said no."
5 names that I can hardly stand to hear, including yours and mine and one more chip who isn't here. I can see the ladies talking how the times are getting hard, and that fearsome excavation on Magnolia Boulevard. Yes, I'm going insane, and I'm laughing at the frozen rain. Well, I'm so stopping
that white tuxedo, how you gonna beat the heat? Do you take me for a fool? Do you think that I don't see that ditch out in the valley that they're digging just for me? Yes, I'm
gone insane.
You know I'm laughing at the frozen rain. I feel like a song.
Each of you were, born and raised there in New York City and went to school in upstate. And yet prior to the Royal Scam album, you lived and recorded the Steely Dan albums up to that point in L.A. How do you think the contrasting environments affected the songwriting?
The reason we were out in L.A. is that we got a job out in L.A. with ABC, what was then ABC Records, as staff songwriters, and we got the band together out there. So, and I think that the fact that we were, you know, exiled from New York to Los Angeles, I think it did provide a lot of material for a song for. The songs, and also a general sort of a psychological ambiance.
It heightened our, our delusions, our persecution delusions to a new all-time high.
It's kind of, Salvador Dali used to talk about a method he had of painting where he would, before he painted a picture, he would have to get himself into this ultra-paranoid state, which he called the paranoia critical method. And I think that's probably what we were forced into using at that time.
Right.
It's kind of, I've often wondered, if the music had that kind of edge and kind of contrast because of your East Coast sensibilities, writing it down in La La Land, it's almost like turning the contrast on the color TV up all the way, listening to Steely Dan songs.
That's funny you say that, because that's how I used to watch all the time.
Katie tried. I was halfway crucified. I was on the other side of no tomorrow. You walked in, and my life began again. Just when I'd spent the last piaster I could borrow. All night long, we would sing that stupid song. And every word we sang I knew was true. Are you with me, Dr. Wu? Are you really
just a shadow of the man that I once knew. Are you crazy? Are you high? Or just an ordinary guy? Have you done all you can do? Are you with me, doctor?
Were making such masterpieces as Asia, how did you ensure that it would remain timeless in a fickle pop culture, you know, popularity and taste?
Yeah, how did we do that?
How
Donald?
Did you do that? Well, popularity and
well,
taste are moving targets.
Well, we insisted that they keep printing up the CDs right up to the present time. So far it's timeless. We'll have to see.
You know, I think one of the things that Donald and I tried to do when we were putting together the album, since we were, you know, judging from the way other people's albums sound over the years, I'm forced to conclude that they often have a real shortage of songs and, have to make do with whatever ones they're able to come up with by the time to start the album. But Donald and I did have plenty of songs. We were able to write songs fairly easily, and so I think the main thing that we did was try to pick songs that really were good and had, some lasting structural worthiness. You know,
it's called the no filler concept.
Yeah. Well, you
something alien, you know, to most American projects.
No, that's true. You also took your time in a time when the industry expected really a new album every 6 months to at the most a year. You did work at your own pace, did you not?
Pretty much, certainly. I guess we put out an album perhaps every 2 years instead of every year, which is what the record company used to expect. But, if you want no filler, you have to have some time to write enough songs so that you can, pick the best of those.
Yeah. I'd like a response from each of you, if you could. Which albums hold up best over time for each of you, and why?
Well, I think they hold up equally well. I use them for drink coasters, and I trade them in at the local used record store, and they seem to be glad, just as glad to get, one as the other.
Which one would you love to step back in time and do over, Walter?
Well, that's an easy question, Redbeard.
Yeah, right. I'd say none of the above on that one.
None albums, mm-hmm. as the. I don't think I don't really see any reason to, think that you could go back and do anything better or do it again and enjoy it the way you did the first time.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you said that you enjoyed it the way you did the first time. That's a good point, Donald. Which albums hold up best for you over time?
I actually don't get that much of an occasion to hear them. I think if I was going to say generally, some of the later ones, I think more than the earlier ones, because, you know, I guess I think of the earlier ones as some sort of juvenilia of some sort. But I think the earlier ones hold up very well as juvenilia.
Wasn't he that guy that used to pitch for the...
Yeah. Ray Juvenilia?
Hector Juvenilia, I was thinking of. Yeah. Chicago, wasn't it?
Maybe Ray was his brother, the hockey player.
I could have been.
Just don't know, these things are gone forever. good.
Now, when did you realize that Steely Dan had acquired a certain mystery that really has maintained to this day? When did you realize it?
I just realized that now.
Oh, come on.
Well, you know, if you read, you know, the music media, you know, there started to be this sort of thing about, you know, this mystique. I really think it really had to do with the fact that we stopped touring and no one would ever see us, and yet we'd continue to put out records that sold well. So, you know, that was about it, really.
Also, your countenance never appeared on any Steely Dan album covers, on the fronts anyway. And
there's a good reason for that.
And, and why is that, guys?
I can't remember somebody we knew or said, oh, some critic once early on when we first started playing said, you know, it was with the ugliest band they'd ever seen.
How do you think Steely Dan would fare breaking into the business in this MTV video era?
No chance.
Not a chance in hell.
Nah.
Nah, we'd have to work in a bookstore.
We'd be bloop out of luck.
Now, you're both bright boys, so one of the few criticisms by the late 70s.
Not according to my biology teacher, Mr. Beemuller, in high school.
Did he flunk you?
Almost. A lot of tap dancing now, yeah.
Yeah. One of the few criticisms that ever I think stuck was that you were maybe too clever, too lyrically coy. This was in the late 70s. But, you know, in my lengthy conversations, particularly with Walter, I've always heard really sincere humility. What devices do you employ to kind of keep each other grounded?
Sincere humility is the one I use the most.
In what way are you using the word grounded?
Electrically.
Electrically. Well, there's lightning rods on the ends of our glasses.
Donald has a alligator clip, which goes from his...
You know what it is? It's those three prongs. You got to have a third prong.
That's the third prong, yeah. Exactly.
Guess what my next question was? How about humor? Your collective sense.
No place for it.
No place for it. You're too serious, right?
We have a serious message to deliver, and we can't jeopardize our ability to deliver that with some silly jokes.
I really think that's one of the things that I've enjoyed most about Steely Dan music, and also about interviewing you guys, is the kind of a collective sense of, I think they called it in the booklet, urban humor.
I think we watched too many of those Steve Allen shows, you know, those early ones.
Exactly.
Good. That's very true. Your sense of humor is very much like that. You know, when we talked individually in the summer of 1990, each one of you individually downplayed the cessation of touring in 74 and the lack thereof until recently. But in the box set, the Citizen Steely Dan essays in the booklet, really, you kind of self-consciously allow much to be made of the return to live performance. Is this conveniently self-serving, or have you really had a change of heart regarding making your music in front of Steely Dan fans?
Again, I think both.
Both change of heart. Mm-hmm. And you know what's really changed more than anything else is... The situation we're in, which back when we were touring in the early 70s, it was a very, the quality of the performances was extremely uneven and unpredictable from night to night. We were barely making enough money to go out and actually do it with at all, you know.
Technically, the sound was, you know.
Yeah, it was a drag. You know, there were a lot of things going on that made it not very much fun to do, and you couldn't really be confident that you were going to put on good shows, you know, and acquit yourself well.
We had to open for Sha Na Na.
Wow.
We did open for Sha Na Na.
Wow.
That was a weird triple bill. It was Chuck Berry, Sha Na Na, and Steely Dan.
Actually, I like that one.
Yeah. Well, it was, but I mean, you have to wonder who put that one together. Whether
yeah.
there was some mistake, you know, whether they'd gotten us mistaken. Us for some other band,
or maybe
you
know? They
opening for Slade was really
Slade.
That was yeah. an honor.
Mm. So what were your concerns initially when you decided to make the big leap almost 19, 20 years later? What were your initial concerns about taking it out?
I think one of the concerns was we didn't want to be seen as a you know nostalgia band, and so we you know we. Got the kind of players we knew would add something to the tunes. We tried to change the arrangements a bit of some of the old tunes so we'd have some fun playing them. And, of course, I think one thing was automatic in keeping it away from the nostalgia thing is that we, because we hadn't been on the road in so many years, most of the tunes we were doing had never been played live, so we were essentially approaching, you know, a new bunch of tunes that we'd never really worked with before, and I think that that was really part of it.
If I had my way, I would move to another lifetime. I'd quit my job, ride the train. The misty nighttime. I'd be ready when my feet touch ground. Wherever I come down. And if the folks will have me, then they'll have me.
Any world that I'm welcome to, I say. Any world that I'm welcome to. Any world that I'm welcome to
is better than the one. See your hand reaching out through a shining daydream where the days and nights are not the same, captured happy in a picture frame. Honey, I will be there, yes, I'll be there.
In a world that I'm welcome
to, in a world we'll do,
in a world that I'm welcome
to. Watch the children playing. Perhaps I'll find in my head what my heart.